Good morning.
Good morning.
Good morning. Oh, well. Let's say the lecture verse. The unsurpassed, penetrating, and perfect truth is seldom met with, even in 100,000 myriad kalpas. Now we can see and hear it. We can remember and accept it. I vow to make the Buddha's truth one with myself. Amisha the Buddha, Amisha the Dharma, Amisha the Sangha. So that's a beautiful ceremony. I always really like Parinirvana. And what I thought I'd talk about today is some thoughts about grieving and loss. It's the Buddha's Parinirvana, pretty big loss. You know, the Buddha's time-wise is way removed from us. So I don't know if we actually grieve, but, you know, we sure have gratitude, which is part of grieving, actually. If you don't know this, Parinirvana is translated as perfect quietude, complete nirvana, complete and final extinction of greed, hate, and delusion, eternal meditation. These are all just some different translations, explanations of it. And if you look at that scroll, which I suggest you look at after, it's really beautiful, the scroll on the altar in front of the statue. River Master brought that from Japan. I think there's a whole story with that. But it's really a beautiful scroll. And of course, nobody knows what the Buddha looked like. None of us were there, or none of the person who created the scroll was not there at the time of the Buddha's death, but this is their depiction of it. And in that picture, the Buddha is lying there, dead, but looks very peaceful. And there are a number of monks and lay followers of the Buddha around the Buddha, looking pretty upset. I looked at it a couple times, and there's quite a few people looking pretty upset. The Buddha just died. I think if I were there, I would have been upset. I probably would have cried. I'm a crier. I have to be ashamed of it. And some of us are criers. Some of us are more stoic. It's just how it is. Okay? Different things move us. Years ago, River Master Jiyu said something that caught my attention, and about that picture. She said, in reference to the scroll, maybe it's the people that are crying who are the enlightened ones. Because we have this idea of, someone who has some great spiritual attainment, they have no emotion. You know, water just bounces off. Everything bounces off them. I don't think so. Okay. And I think River Master Jiyu was pushing back a little bit on that whole, figure out how to do this so these don't fall on the floor. Let's do that. Okay. Pushing back on that whole idea that spiritually advanced people don't show emotion, don't grieve. River Master Jiyu herself shed a tear, cried when her cat died. It was a dear cat. You know, it was sad for her. She loved the cat. And the Buddha himself, when his two chief disciples died, Shariputra and Moggallana, he was upset. He grieved. You know, I think they were older than him in age, but he was the teacher. Like, you know, the student shouldn't die first. The teacher should die first. But it happens how it happens. When Shariputra died, he said to Ananda, this is the Buddha who was grieving too, it is, Ananda, as though from a mighty hardwood tree, it's basically a large branch should break off. So has Shariputra now passed away from this great and sound community of monks. Have I not taught you, Ananda, that it is the nature of all things near and dear to us that we must suffer separation from them and be severed from them? Of that which is born, come into being, put together, and so is subject to disillusion, how should it be said that it should not depart? This is just the way it is. The Buddha also said to Ananda, he said, be an island. You know, the verse that we sang, interesting, entering the ceremony and leaving, be a light unto yourself, be a lamp unto yourself. So the Buddha said, be an island unto yourself, a refuge unto yourself, with the Dharma as your refuge. So we have this refuge of the Dharma, okay, which is more than just us. It's the Dharma. It's all this teaching and training of all these years of people. So grief is a natural human reaction to loss. If you love and care, you will grieve. So what are you going to do? Not love and care? Pretty dismal life if you did that. And of course, grief takes different forms for different of us. And grief in itself is not a problem. The problem comes from holding on to an attachment to what we are grieving about, wanting it to be different than it is. That's actually a definition of training. It's also of suffering. Wanting things to be different than they are. You got what you got. Grief sometimes takes time to work through. Reverend Master Zhu said when someone close to us dies, we can grieve for 3 years. But the world doesn't stop while we're grieving. She's not talking about a grieving where we're just, you know, crying all day long and, you know, not able to do anything and not being able to function. But there's a grief of that loss. So I wanted to tell you about a few of the things that have happened in my life, they're no different than yours in that there's no one in this room who hasn't lost someone who is near to them. I don't think so. If you live, if you're lucky to live to be older, well, there's more people. Okay. So when I was about 13, my best friend died very suddenly. He I don't know if he was partying or what the night before, but he threw up in his sleep, and he strangled on that and died. And his parents were medical people. They tried to do something. I think they even maybe tried a tracheotomy, but it didn't work. And Steve was my best friend. He was my hero. He was a good student. He was a leader. He's super handsome. But most of all, he was just a nice guy. Just a really nice, sweet guy. And, you know, that was a loss for a while. I mean, didn't see him physically again. We were still close with the family for many, many years. So, you know, I'd be reminded of it in a sense, but that was okay. It was another big family. I came from a big family. It was another big family. And we were kind of matching ages. And Steve was a year older than me, but, you know, close. So that was a loss at a young age. I think I was a pallbearer, but I can't remember now. Carried the coffin. My mother died in 1983, so I was here as a monk. She raised 7 kids, and she went back to nursing. She was a cancer outpatient nurse. She did this after everybody, but my youngest sister had left home because there was quite a distance in years between my youngest sister and the rest of us. She, in her early 60s, she retired from nursing, and 6 months later, she was dead. She had what's kind of the curse of our family. It was a pulmonary embolism. They tried to operate and milk the blood clots out of her lungs, but the problem was they couldn't get her lungs going again. And it was a long night was happening. And because my mother was really liked by the nurses when she was at this hospital in Reno, they would bring us news, you know. And my brothers and sisters were saying, you know, she's a fighter, she'll make it. I didn't think so. And, sorry, it's still emotional, but she died, okay? And that night I was in a motel room with my dad and a number of my brothers. You know, we didn't sleep very well, obviously. You know, people were alternating weeping through the night. And I remember the thought arising in my mind that it was unfair. Here she was, she raised 7 kids, you know, went back to her nursing field and then retired. And then she dies. The only thing, you know, I could think was my retirement wasn't really for my mother. She wasn't retiring type. She's always doing something, okay. But anyway, I watched that. I don't know if I said this yet, but this thought of unfairness arose in my mind that night. This is unfair. Well, it was unfair, but what does that mean? It doesn't bring your mother back. She's dead. So I just, you know, kind of let it go on through because I could see it just wasn't a place to stay. If it's unfair, you're probably going to get angry, upset, you know, morose, whatever. Just unfair doesn't bring her back. So my mom had written down some things before her death that we found because I think she had left them in a prominent place. And these were really helpful, you know, with the next months. She didn't want flowers for her funeral. She wanted the money to go to cancer research. You know, she said, don't waste flowers on me. Her main concern was that she knew people would be sad and grieving, and she didn't want that to go on for long. You know, she wanted people to move on. She put on her grave, she wanted it on her gravestone with love. Just those 2 words. So towards the end of my mom's nursing career, she worked with Kubler-Ross. She had met her in some extension classes she had to take as a nurse, and she helped with the movement of dignity in dying, which was going on at that time. I found this out years later. I found a newspaper article somewhere about her. So my mom dies, you know, that I come back to the Abbey maybe a couple weeks later. You know, that it was still in winter because it was March that she died in. And I would look at the barren bushes around with no leaves on them, and I would think, well, that's going to die. And I kind of had, that was kind of my thing when I looked at things, but it wasn't negative. It was like I'd been given this great gift of seeing life's impermanent, you know, so, and things are impermanent, and it's okay, you know. And, you know, I grieved for quite a while with her. Okay, so in 1996, her Master Jiyu died. Well, the night before she died, I was at her house, and she was kind of in and out of consciousness. She's really sick, poor woman. All the time I had known her, she was sick, but she was really sick at this point, and it was serious. And actually, I was going to have a double hernia surgery the next day, and so at some point that evening, she woke up and kind of conscious for a bit, and she asked me, she said, Daishin, what time's your surgery? And then she drifted off again, okay. So it turns out that I had the surgery. She died the next day, but she didn't die till I was out of surgery. And she was my teacher, my friend, and I learned a lot from her. And I was really grateful for her. And we grieved her loss. Okay, this is the hard one. So my sister, Jeannie, died in June of 2022. It's almost 3 years ago now since her death. Her death was a shock. And I had a call from one of my brothers who never calls me. And I thought, because my other brother was really sick at the time, and I thought, well, he's died. And, you know, Vince is, or something's gone on. But my brother said, Jeannie's died. So I think I dropped the phone. And fortunately, I was able to see her at the funeral home before they took her away, because she was donating a lot of her body to science, just like my sister. She was a nurse practitioner. And she was the nurse practitioner for a lot of the monks here. She was my medical person. She was my sister. She was my good friend. And she did a lot for our community here and the community of Mount Shasta. So, but I was able to see her at the funeral home. You know, it was closed, but they let us in, and they wheeled her out of the fridge. And you know, my sister was a redhead. She was really, I thought she was very pretty, and it was good to see her, even though she was dead. And so I have her picture on my altar. I haven't been able to take it down. Okay. So, last one I'll put you through. So last June, Reverend Master Enyan and myself traveled to Oklahoma to be with our friend who was being executed. Okay, I was finally, after 20-something years of trying, realized as a spiritual director. For some reason, it always would fall through. But I got it. You know, I worked with the chaplain. We got to see Daiji in the week before his death. We went a number of days early, and we got to meet with him. I got to meet with him alone and in a room with him. You know, he was shackled, but there's a guard in there who was very nice. But I got to talk with him, and Reverend Enyan and myself got to talk with him behind a grate, some kind of metal grate. And they gave us extra time, which was really nice. Okay. And then the day of the execution, I was in the execution chamber, and Reverend Enyan was in the friends section. So you have the execution chamber itself. You have a room where the friends of the person who's going to be put to death is, and then behind that there's another room where the family of the victim can be. I was able to be in the room with him. I could be at his feet. I think there was one point where I could kind of move towards his waist, and I recited the scripture of Avalokiteshvara before he died. He went quickly. You know, it was lethal injection. I think he died peacefully, as far as I could see. I mean, it took a matter of minutes. First, they make the person unconscious. They come in, they make sure that they're unconscious. Then they give them the lethal drugs. And that's, drugs are done from a room off the side of the death chamber, so you can't see the medical people in the room. You know, the whole experience was surreal. And I flash back on it now over the months since he was executed. You know, going into the jail, which I'd been in before, but the polished cement floors from just mopping, they're kind of polished cement, and all the bars and the, you know, and you have to go into a death row unit and then go upstairs, and you know, just go through all the clanging and bars, and then you get into the death chamber itself, and there are just a few people in there, but one of the, I presume, guards has a hood over their face, completely covering their face for anonymity, which is fine. Well, yeah, it's just what they do. I mean, I will say it was a horrendous experience, and people were really nice to us. This is the prison people. And but, you know, the execution happened. Then you go back out of the death chamber. You have to kind of do everything in reverse and go and head out into the parking lot. And as we headed out in the parking lot, we heard this, I think it was a hawk, fly away from the prison. And somebody said that that rarely ever happens. Well, I thought, oh, he's free now. I don't know. Who knows? But, you know, it was an interesting coincidence. Okay. And I had known Daiji for 25 years. He'd been on death row for 40 years. He always maintains his innocence. He was a Buddhist. I went and gave him the precepts. In the early 2000s. And he was a real meditator. Okay, so if you ever think that you're struggling with your meditation or you have difficult circumstances to meditate, try death row. It's not a quiet place, you know. But he kept it up. And, you know, Reverend Enya and myself, in the last month, we talked to him. We were able to somehow call him, or he called us, I don't remember, and talked to him and all that. Kept getting broken up. But we had some good conversations. And one of the things we really talked to him about is letting go of any anger he had for his situation, for the people in the prison system, for the unfairness. Because it's not a good thing to leave life angry. It's just not, I don't think it makes for a good rebirth. You don't want to give that to anybody. Okay. So that's my stories. I'm sure you have many, many too, and some, you know, tougher situations. It's the way it is. It's just the way it is. So the Buddha gave some teaching on grief, which I think is very simple and good and concrete and something that we can think about. He was with the king Pasendi, if I'm saying that right, okay, when the king's favorite queen, Malika, died. They had multiple queens, I think. But this was his favorite, and she died, and the king was totally overcome with shock and sorrow. He just kind of bowed down, and he couldn't speak. And so the Buddha was there, and he responds to him with three teachings. And so I'm going to read these, and these are actually taken from the Buddha scriptures, but I got them directly from an article by Tanisaro Bhikkhu called An Arrow in the Heart. Okay. The Buddha immediate response was to teach him three things to do to manage his grief. The first was to reflect on the universality of loss. No one anywhere, no matter how powerful, can arrange for what is subject to change not to change, or for what is subject to death not to die. To the extent that there are beings, past, present, and future, change and death happen to all of them. This thought helps take some of the personal sting out of the loss, allowing you to acquiesce to what has happened and not to waste energy in trying to undo what can't be undone. So, you know, death is there's a universality. We all know about it. We all know people. The second step the Buddha taught to the king was that as long as he saw that traditional funeral observances performed a useful function in giving skillful expression to his sense of loss and to his appreciation for the person who was now gone, he should arrange them. The Buddha never advocated that his listeners try to smother their grief with feigned indifference. As long as they felt a need to express their loss, they should try to do it in a skillful and healing way. Among the observances he mentions as potentially useful were eulogies, donations, and the recital of wise sayings. If you actually want to help the person who has passed on, you do good and dedicate the merit to your loved one. To heal the wound in your heart and to encourage goodness, in the people still alive, you show your appreciation for your loved one's goodness. So, you know, those things can all be helpful. The Buddha mentions this last point as a motivation for gathering energy for the third step, which is to remind yourself that there are still good things to accomplish in life, and that for the sake of your true well-being and that of others, you need to get back to the good work that the loss has interrupted. With all these things that we grieve, life doesn't end. I mean, it may take a while, and you can't just say to somebody, oh, get over it, you know, that's really unskillful. But, you know, in time, people get over things. We're all headed that way, you know. I mean, the Buddha lived to 80. Would we want him to have lived to be alive for 2,580 years so he could teach us? I mean, it doesn't make sense. And, you know, it's like River Master Jiyu, she was sick, you know. And my friend on death row, he was tired of the whole scene. You know, it wasn't that he gave up, but he was tired. You know, he tried so many things over the years to try to get his innocence out there, and it just didn't fly. So the Buddha said to Ananda, of that which is born, come into being, put together, and so is subject to disillusion, how should it be said that it should not depart? That indeed is not possible. So all things are subject to change. If we're born, the one certainty is that someday we're going to die. We can't live forever. Our loved ones can't live forever. Our friends can't live forever. You know, even the Buddha had to die. But look at all the Dharma and love and things that people that we know have died have left behind. And this is the true refuge. It's the Dharma. Okay? It's okay to grieve. It's because we care and love, and that's good. As I said before, do we want to not care and love? Because we could possibly be hurt. Miserable. Miserable existence. Okay? Just don't hold on to the grieving. Let it take its natural course. Because it does. You know, I think someday I'm going to move my sister's picture off my altar. I don't know. Maybe it'll be this year. 3 years. Sometimes there may be a little hole in our hearts, you know. Some people are, you can't replace them. One of a kind. You know, they had this deep impression on your life. But you might have a little hole in your heart. That doesn't get in the way of expanding the spiritual heart, expanding our generosity and kindness in our heart. Because that's what benefits everybody, even the person that's died. So, you know, we need to make the Dharma our refuge and share in the joy that fills the universe. Thank you.